not by my watch. My watch is just full. All right, everyone, good afternoon. We have an hour together this evening, so let's try to make the most of it. I'm going to go over some passages from the Lankavatara Sutra, some excerpts from the Lankavatara Sutra. Actually, I had a difficult time deciding what excerpts to give you from the discourse. It's a very long and complex discourse, as I told you. And when I started reading through the entire sutra, it just baffled me. I didn't really know what passages to select, what chapters to select. So in the end, I let the decision be made by an internet website that had some excerpts from the Lankavatara Sutra, and I just took those. They're taken from chapter 1 and chapter 2, and then some from some of the later chapters. So I just downloaded those excerpts, and I thought that was probably as good as we could do, as best we could do without reading the whole discourse. As I say, the discourse is a very long one and a very complex one. It has some very interesting special characteristics. For example, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but it is the Lankavatara Sutra that is the authority for the practice of vegetarianism among Mahayanists, and particularly in China, among Buddhists. The Lankavatara Sutra has a chapter on vegetarianism and how one should be vegetarian, should avoid eating meat. To my knowledge, there's no text in the Pali Canon that expressly advocates vegetarianism, but the Lankavatara does. That doesn't happen to be one of the excerpts that we have, but it is there in the sutra. So all of you who are vegetarians, you have your scriptural basis in the Lankavatara Sutra. So I've just taken a few points from the excerpts that I've given you, and I touched upon one of them this morning. The sutra begins with a description of the location and the audience. And this is also an indication of the extraordinary nature of the sutra, because, as I think I said before, the sutra is delivered in Lanka, in what was called Ceylon, what is now called Sri Lanka. So historically, of course, we have no documentation of the Buddha having visited Sri Lanka. Just as we have no historical documentation of the Buddha having visited northern Thailand or a number of other places. But the legend exists, and the sutra is believed to have been delivered on a peak on a mountain in Lanka, on the island of Lanka. The assembly is composed of bodhisattvas and mahasattvas. Mahasattvas is just another name for bodhisattvas, meaning advanced bodhisattvas and so on. And the discourse is delivered primarily to one of these bodhisattvas named Mahamati, or Great Intelligence. I mentioned this morning the occurrence of the simile or the analogy of the ocean, the wind, and the waves. And my point this morning was that here we see an alternative application of this simile, whereas in the body of the text, the simile is used to express how, because of discrimination, because of the subject-object duality, the six ordinary senses become agitated and people collect the impressions of sense experience and the seeds of karma, and so circle in samsara. But here in the beginning of the sutra, we have the same analogy but applied instead to the activity of the Buddha. So in this particular case, the discrimination is not a discrimination born of subject-object duality. It's not a discrimination born of egotism or egocentrism or belief in self. It's a discrimination which is born of compassion. So the tranquility of the mind of the Buddha is stirred by compassion for living beings. So you can see that in this sense, the storehouse consciousness, the ocean, the original mind, when it has been purified and when the being associated with it is an enlightened being, a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, then the storehouse consciousness and even the faculty of discrimination becomes positive. It's no longer negative. It becomes part and parcel of the activity of the Buddha for the purpose of liberating living beings. So this is part, and an important part, is a part of the conception in the Mahayana tradition of the activity of the Buddha. So the Buddha, even though he is free from all klesha and free from all attachment, aversion and ignorance and so forth, and he is free, still he engages in activity for the liberation of living beings, in order to liberate living beings. Now, some people might think, well, in that case, the Buddha must be thinking all the time. The Buddha must be always engaged in some sort of thought processes. But actually, this is not the case, because according to the Mahayana, the advanced bodhisattvas and the Buddhas, they act to liberate living beings automatically, spontaneously. They don't have to think about that. It just happens automatically. It happens automatically because they've been programmed, so to speak. They've been trained to respond to the needs of sentient beings, to act for the liberation of sentient beings by these long aeons of training, of practice of the Bodhisattva path. So, as one modern writer put it, the advanced Bodhisattvas and the Buddhas are, so to speak, on autopilot. They don't need to think about how to save living beings. It's just a spontaneous reaction. It's a reaction of the being of a Buddha, without having to consider, without having to think about it, without having to get involved in thought processes, to be able to liberate living beings automatically or spontaneously. And that's why we use the example of the wind chime. The wind chime doesn't have to think about how it should respond to the wind that blows against it. It just responds automatically, spontaneously, to the character of the wind that strikes against it. So in the same way, the Bodhisattvas and the Buddhas, they just react spontaneously in order to liberate living beings without having to deliberate, without having to make an effort. In the Mahayana tradition, we call this the achintya karma of the Buddhas, the inconceivable action of the Buddhas. It's inconceivable because it isn't meditated, it isn't planned, it isn't deliberate, it just happens spontaneously. There's another example that is sometimes given. It's the example of a physician who is skilled in alleviating or creating an antidote, purifying snake poison. Now, such a person, it was believed in ancient India, could erect a pillar, erect a post that would have the power to purify snake poison even long after the physician had passed along, had gone elsewhere. So even after the physician had gone elsewhere, the pillar, the post that he left behind still has the power to purify snake poison. So in the same way, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they have built up this spontaneous reaction mechanism designed to liberate living beings, so that even when they are liberated themselves, they don't have to think about how to liberate living beings, but they continue to, their activity persists in the world spontaneously in an automatic and inconceivable way to liberate living beings. So here also the Buddha reacts to the requirements of the audience and delivers the discourse. And the first thing that the Buddha says is that he says the truth of the world is that the world is like a dream. Now, one thing that you will notice in this discourse and in these excerpts is that there's a very liberal use of examples and similes. And this, I told you right at the beginning of the course, right at the beginning of our consideration of the Mahayana Sutra literature, that the Mahayana Sutras make a great deal of use. They use simile and metaphor and example to a very large degree. And you can see this also in this discourse and in these excerpts. So we have first and foremost the simile of the dream, which we have encountered already. I must have mentioned the example of the dream to you dozens of times already in the course of these lectures. The world is like a dream. Objects are like objects seen in a dream. This is actually recommended as a kind of meditation. And when I say meditation, I don't mean necessarily that one has to be seated cross-legged in order to do this. This is a kind of meditation that one can do whatever situation one happens to be in. But to occasionally reflect or even to constantly reflect upon what we experience as similar to a dream. This is recommended as a meditation which is conducive to understanding the ultimate truth, to understanding the fact that everything is not substantial, that everything is empty, everything is beyond existence and non-existence. So if you can, if you care to occasionally or as often as you remember, to think of what you see, what you hear, what you experience as similar to experiences in a dream, that is a practice which is conducive to awakening an awareness of the ultimate truth, an awareness of the illusory nature of the world. Sutra goes on to list other examples, other similes, the simile of the magical show or the magical illusion. This is another simile which I have mentioned to you. It also refers to the reflection. Well, in this case it simply says that the world is like a reflection. Some places we'll see it said the world is like a reflection, the reflection of the moon and water. Now the reflection of the moon and water, you can't say that it exists or that it doesn't exist. Again, the sutra gives the example of a shadow. All things are like shadows. All things are like echoes. So these are all examples of things that, you know, originate interdependently. The reflection originates interdependently. The magical show is produced by causes and conditions. And we'll look at this in more detail when we look at the scholastic literature. But the idea is that all of these are interdependently produced and all of these are insubstantial. Now, the sutra says because of discrimination and because of the subject-object duality, people cling to this and that. So it's because of imagination that people become attached to various objects. The discourse goes on now in the words referring to the mental perception, the way in which the Buddha perceives the world. Mahamati says, the world-honored one, the Buddha, perceives the world as similar to a flower growing in the sky. Now, again, this is one of those examples of emptiness that is quite common in the Mahayana Sutra literature. A flower growing in the sky, the son of a barren woman, you know. These are examples of things that are in fact non-existent, but of course they exist to the extent that you can think of them. You can think of a flower growing in the sky. So in that sense, by thinking of a flower growing in the sky, it's not non-existent. It has some sort of existence, but it's also not really existent because it's just an impossibility. It's something which is just imagined. We can imagine a flower growing in the sky, but there really aren't any flowers growing in the sky. And so for that reason, the world being similar to a flower growing in the sky is not originated and it's not destroyed. So again, here we have the message of non-origination, ajati. These imaginary objects like a flower growing in the sky are not originated, and because they're not originated, so they also are not destroyed. Neither are they existent, nor non-existent, permanent, nor impermanent. So these categories of existence, non-existence, permanence, and impermanence don't apply to things that are simply the products of imagination. Again, the sutra reminds us that all persons and all factors are insubstantial. This is the twofold insubstantiality. This is a characteristic of Mahayana philosophy, which you should remember, that in addition to pudgala naidatmya, or the insubstantiality of the personality, so in the Mahayana we also emphasize the insubstantiality of dharmas, the insubstantiality of factors. Referring to nirvana, the sutra says that nirvana is beyond all dualities. This has been a common question over the course of these days. What is nirvana? How do we describe nirvana? Well, nirvana is beyond all duality. Nirvana is beyond the duality of the knower, knowing, and the known. So in other words, nirvana cannot be cognized in the ordinary way because it's beyond the duality of the subject of knowledge and the object of knowledge. It's beyond existence and non-existence. This we are already very familiar with even from the Pali texts. The sutra says praise and blame apply to the world but not to the Dharmakaya. So the Dharmakaya is beyond praise and blame. So the sutra goes on to say again that birth and death are the result of ignorance. In this particular case, it is the ignorance of the fact that the world is just mind. The world is just a manifestation of mind. Therefore, people imagine birth and death. They cling to multiple objects because of the discrimination between subject and object. They conceive of one and many, of things as being one or being different, as being the same or being different. This is another duality which becomes important in the Mahayana tradition, although it is also there in the Theravada analysis, the Theravada consideration of the 14 views, the last set, which includes only two views, the living being and the soul, the living being and the body, are they identical or are they different? Are they one thing or are they two things? Are they one or are they different? So the one and the difference duality, the identity and difference duality exists there in the case of the living being and the body, but it also applies to other objects. Are objects the same thing or are they different? This again also we will investigate in more detail when we look at the scholastic literature. So people generate these ideas of one and many. They generate the ideas of existence and non-existence. They cling to the ideas of eternity and non-eternity, permanence and impermanence, because of discrimination. So discrimination, habit energy, which is of course the accumulated force of karma, the accumulated force of habit, of habitual attitudes, developed over the course of countless lifetimes. All of these, together with imagination or discrimination, lead to the conceptions of origination and destruction. But in fact, the world is similar to a mirage. Another example here of illusion, a mirage. A fairy city. A fairy city is another favorite example of illusion. In Indian mythology, there was a belief in a class of beings called the Gandharvas, who were musicians, heavenly musicians, and they were believed to live in a city in the sky. So again, here it said the world is like a fairy city. Again, it is like a dream, or it's like a country remembered in a dream. Like when you awake from a dream, you remember what you saw in the dream, there's an impression, a recollection, a memory of what you saw in the dream. Again, the sutra says, the world is like a painter's canvas. And this occurs also in another one of the Mahayana texts, where it says that samsara is like a painting drawn by an artist, a painting of a demon, of a fearful demon. It's just as though, just as if a painter were to paint a picture of a terrifying demon and then were to be terrified and frightened by that painting. So in the same way, we paint a picture of samsara and then we're trapped in that picture. We're terrified and suffer in that picture. We're frightened by that picture. But actually, samsara is of our own making, it's of our own creation. We paint this picture, we project this picture, and then we're afraid of it. The world is also like the circle of the whirling firebrand. I don't know whether you're familiar with this image, but if you take a torch and you whirl it around very rapidly, then you see, the other person see what looks like a circle of fire. It's not actually a circle of fire, it's just that the flame of the torch is circling very rapidly, and so it produces the illusion of a circle of fire. So again, an example of illusion. The world is an illusion. And it's only because of ignorance, because of discrimination, that people cling to names, to signs, to concepts, to the ideas of a person, to the ideas of dharmas. This is only the result of imagination. Again, people having these ideas believe in good and bad action. They accumulate karma, karma born of the afflictions, karma born of ignorance, attachment and aversion, and they're caught in samsara. As a result of this, they circle in samsara because of the actions born of the afflictions, produced by the afflictions, and the afflictions, of course, are the result of the subject-object duality. They're synonymous with the subject-object duality, and the dichotomy between self and other, which is none other than ignorance, and this produces attachment and aversion, karma. As a result, people are trapped in the circle of samsara, continue to circle in the cycle of birth and death. But as a matter of fact, this whole world, the circle of samsara, the wheel of existence, the bhava chakra, this whole world is just maya, it's just illusion. It's like magic, it's like illusion. This term also becomes important in the Mahayana tradition. The references to Maya. Maya is also a magical show. When we refer to a magical show, we're referring to things created by a magician, things created by magic. Can translate Maya as magic also. So the origination of the world is also a subject which people have speculated about. And here the text contains a list of erroneous causes of the world. And this is, in fact, quite interesting because this is, someone was asking me yesterday, I think it was, about coincidences or similarities between Mahayana texts and Pali texts, and this is one area where there are some similarities. Throughout the Buddhist tradition, we find occurring here and there in the Pali texts, in some of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, and here in the Lankavatara, and again in the writing of Nagarjuna and so on, we find a list of erroneous causes of the world. And these are semi-historical, we can call these somewhat objectively documented, because we can identify these erroneous causes of the world with certain philosophical schools that existed during the time of the Buddha, around the time of the Buddha, before and after the time of the Buddha. And these philosophical schools had different theories about how the world originated. Just like the Christians believed that God created the world, there was a school in ancient India also that believed that God created the world. So there were various theories of how the world came into existence. And these theories are mentioned in the different texts. In the Lankavatara there's quite a long list and quite a complicated list of erroneous or spurious causes of the world. And it includes, for example, a creator, which of course would be some sort of creator god. It also includes time, because there was a school in ancient India that believed that the world originated from time. It also includes atoms. Now, I'm not 100% sure what this reference is to exactly. Certainly the Sankhya school of ancient Indian thought believed that the world originated from matter and spirit. Maybe this reference to atoms is a reference to matter. The next element in the list that comes up, the next spurious cause, is spirit. Then we have got soul mentioned as an erroneous cause. We have God mentioned as an erroneous cause. So the sutra cites all these erroneous causes of the world, but it says, in fact, the world is just a manifestation of mind. The world arises out of mind. It's a projection of mind. It's a mental projection. In the last few paragraphs or a few lines of the excerpts that I've given you, the sutra talks about how one achieves the self-realization of noble wisdom. And this is in fact quite interesting because it's a kind of progressive description of how one realizes the ultimate truth, how one realizes liberating wisdom. And the first step is to recognize that the world is just a manifestation of mind. So the practitioner who wants to realize noble wisdom, liberating insight, first he has to understand, he has to accept that the world is just a manifestation of mind. Next, understand the insubstantiality of personality and of phenomena, the insubstantiality of persons and factors, the twofold insubstantiality that I referred to a moment ago, pudgala nairatmya and dharma nairatmya. So he has to understand these two realities, the insubstantiality of persons and of things. But then the third step is particularly interesting because it also shows us that for the Lankavatara Sutra and in general for the mentalist current of philosophy and Mahayana Buddhism, although the mind is the primary creator of the phenomenal universe, the mind itself is also not an object. The mind itself is not a substance. The mind is not an entity. So the third step in the progress toward noble wisdom, toward the realization of noble wisdom, is to understand that the mind also is just constructed. The mind also is insubstantial. The mind also is empty. So the emptiness of mind is also emphasized in the Lankavatara Sutra. And then finally, unfortunately, I don't know why anyone in their right mind allowed this to happen, but in your excerpt, talks about the four steps for realizing noble wisdom, and it stops the excerpt after the third step, so you don't have the fourth step in your excerpt. I had to go and look it up in the sutra. It's in chapter 8. The fourth step is to rightly understand noble wisdom. And what is noble wisdom? Noble wisdom is not intellectual cognition. It's not a subject-object cognition. It's not ordinary knowledge. Noble wisdom is one, it's identical, it's free from all duality, and it's free from all images and all predication. Actually, this is an idea which is common to all the Mahayana schools, that the ultimate truth is perceived, it is seen. That's why we usually use the language of seeing when we talk about the ultimate truth. The ultimate truth is seen, it's perceived, but it's not perceived in the ordinary way. It's not perceived in the way that you might look at this cup. It's perceived in an extraordinary way. The Sanskrit term for perception is pratyaksha, which literally means before the eyes. But in the case of ultimate truth, the perception of ultimate truth is not ordinary perception, but it is yogic perception. It's the perception of the yogi, which is non-dual perception. So that when the ultimate truth is realized, as we saw a moment ago, there's no duality between the knower and the known. There's no difference between the meditator and the object meditated upon. So the meditator and the object meditated upon, the ultimate truth, emptiness, whatever it may be, become non-dual. They merge in an act of perception which is non-dual, which is a yogic act of perception beyond ordinary cognition. Okay, well, these are some of the more interesting and more important points contained in the excerpts of the sutra which you've been given. And now I think, as we have done with the other texts that we have talked about, I think I'll ask Mrs. Santina to read these excerpts. It's always...
I was going to fall anyway because it is the second time it happened.
Well, let's not,
third time.
Let's not have it happen a third time.
Okay. Be careful.
Move mindfully.
Yes.
So here are some excerpts from the Lankavatara Sutra.
Lankavatara Sutra, Chapter 1. Thus have I heard, the Blessed One once appeared in the castle of Lanka, which is on the summit of Mount Malaya, in the midst of the great ocean. A great many bodhisattva, mahasattvas, and miraculously assembled from all the Buddha lands, and a large number of bhikshus were gathered there. The bodhisattva, mahasattvas with Mahamati, their head, were all perfect masters of the various samadhis, the tenfold self-mastery, the ten powers, and the six psychic faculties. Having been anointed by the Buddha's own hands, they all well understood the significance of the objective world. They all knew how to apply the various means, teachings, and disciplinary measures according to the various mentalities and behaviors of beings. They were thoroughly versed in the five dharmas, the three swabhavas and eight vijnanas, and the twofold egolessness. The Blessed One, knowing of the mental agitations going on in the minds of those assembled, like the surface of the ocean stirred into the waves by the passing winds, and his great heart moved by compassion, smiled and said, "In the days of the old Tathagatas of the past, who were arhats and fully enlightened ones, came to the castle of Lanka on Mount Malaya and discoursed on the truth of the noble wisdom that is beyond the reasoning knowledge and knowledge of the philosophers, as well as being beyond the understanding of ordinary disciples and masters, and which is realizable only within the inmost consciousness of your sakes. I too would discourse on the same truth. All that is seen in the world is devoid of effort and action, because all things in the world are like a dream or like an image miraculously projected. This is not comprehended by the philosophers and the ignorant, but those who thus seen them truthfully. Those who see things otherwise walk in discrimination, and as they depend upon discrimination, they cling to dualism. The world as seen by discrimination is like seeing one's own image reflected in a mirror, or one's shadow, or the moon reflected in water, or an echo heard in the valley. People grasping their own shadows of discrimination become attached to this thing and that thing, and failing to abandon dualism, they go on forever discriminating and thus never attain tranquility. By tranquility is meant oneness, and oneness gives birth to the highest samadhi, which is gained by entering into the realm of noble wisdom that is realizable only within one's inmost consciousness. Then all the bodhisattva, mahasattvas rose from their seats and respectfully paid him homage, and Mahamati, the bodhisattva, mahasattva, sustained by the power of the Buddha, drew his upper garment over one shoulder, knelt and pressing his hands together, praised him in the following verse. As thou reviewest the world with thy perfect intelligence and compassion, it must seem to thee like an ethereal flower of which one cannot say, it is born, it is destroyed, for the terms being and non-being do not apply to it. As thou reviewest the world with the perfect intelligence and compassion, it must seem to thee like a dream of which it cannot be said, it is permanent or it is destructible, or being and non-being do not apply to it. As thou reviewest all things by the perfect intelligence and compassion, they must seem to thee like various beyond the reach of the human mind, as being and non-being do not apply to them. With thy perfect intelligence and compassion, which are beyond all limit, thou comprehendest the egolessness of things and persons, and art free and clear from the hindrances of passion and learning and egoism. Thou doesn't not vanish into nirvana, nor does nirvana abide in thee. For nirvana transcends all duality of knowing and known, of being and non-being. Those who see thee thus serene and beyond conception will be emancipated from attachment, will be cleansed of all defilement, both in this world and in the spiritual world beyond. In this world, those nature is like a dream. There is place for praise and blame. But in the ultimate reality of the Dharmakaya, which is far beyond the senses and the discriminating mind, what is there to praise, O thou most wise? Then said Mahamati, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, O blessed one, Sugata, Arhat and fully enlightened one, pray tell us about the realization of noble wisdom, which is beyond the path and usage of the philosophers, which is devoid of all predicates such as being and non-being, oneness and otherness, bothness and non-bothness, existence and non-existence, eternity and non-eternity, which has nothing to do with individuality and generality, nor false imagination, nor any illusions arising from the mind itself, but which manifests itself as the truth of highest reality, by which going up continuously by the stages of purification, one enters at last upon the stage of Tathagatahood, whereby by the power of his original vows, unattended by any striving, one will radiate its influence to infinite worlds, like a gem reflecting its variegated color, whereby I and other Bodhisattva Mahasattvas will be enabled to bring all beings to the same perfection of virtue. Said the Blessed One, well done, Mahamati, and again well done indeed. It is because of your compassion for the world, because of the benefit it will bring to many people, both humankind and celestial, that you have presented yourself before us to make this request. Therefore, Mahamati, listen well and truly reflect upon what I shall say, for I will instruct you. Then Mahamati and the other Bodhisattva Mahasattvas gave devout attention to the teachings of the Blessed One. Mahamati, since the ignorant and simple-minded, not knowing that the world is only something seen of the mind itself, cling to multitudinousness of external objects, cling to the notions of being and non-being, oneness and otherness, bothness and non-bothness, existence and non-existence, eternity and non-eternity, and think that they have a self-nature of their own, all of which rises from the discriminations of the mind and is perpetuated by habit energy, and from which they are given over to false imagination. It is all like a mirage in which springs of water are seen as if they were real. They are thus imagined by animals who, made thirsty by the heat of the season, run after them. Animals, not knowing that the springs are an hallucination of their own minds, do not realize that there are no such springs. In the same way, Mahamati, the ignorant and simple-minded, their minds burning with the fires of greed, anger, folly, finding delight in the world of multitudinousness forms, their thoughts obsessed with ideas of birth, growth, and destruction, not well understanding what is meant by existent and non-existent, and being impressed by the erroneous discriminations and speculations since beginningless time, fall into the habit of grasping this and that, and thereby becoming attached to them. It is like the city of the Gandharvas, which the unwitting take to be real city, though it is not so in fact. The city appears as in a vision owing to their attachment to the memory of a city preserved in the mind as a seed. The city can thus be said to be both existent and non-existent. In the same way, clinging to the memory of erroneous speculations and doctrines accumulated since beginningless time, they hold fast to such ideas, to oneness and otherness, being and non-being, and their thoughts are not at all clear as to what, after all, is only seen of the mind. It is like a man dreaming in his sleep of a country that seems to be filled with various men, women, elephants, horses, cars, pedestrians, villages, towns, hamlets, cows, buffaloes, mansions, woods, mountains, rivers, and lakes, and who moves about in that city until he is awakened. As he lies half awake, he recalls the city of his dreams and reviews his experience there. What do you think, Mahamati? Is this dreamer who is letting his mind dwell upon the various unrealities he has seen in his dream, is it to be considered wise or foolish? In the same way, the ignorant and simple-minded who are favorably influenced by the erroneous views of the philosophers do not recognize that the views that are influencing them are only dream-like ideas originating in the mind itself, and consequently they are held first by their notions of oneness and otherness, of being and non-being. It is like a painter's canvas on which the ignorant image, they see the elevations and depressions of mountains and valleys. In the same way, there are people today being brought up under the influence of similar erroneous views of oneness and otherness, of bothness and non-bothness, whose mentality is being conditioned by the habit energy of these false imaginations, and who later on will declare those who hold the true doctrine of no birth, which is free from the alternatives of being and non-being, to be nihilists, and by so doing will bring themselves and others to ruin. By the natural law of cause and effect, these followers of pernicious views uproot meritorious causes that otherwise would lead to unsustained purity. It is like the dim-eyed ones who, seeing a hairnet, exclaim to one another, "It is wonderful. Look, honorable sirs, it is wonderful." But the hairnet has never existed. In fact, it is neither an entity nor a non-entity, for it has both been seen and has not been seen. In the same manner, those whose minds have been addicted to the discriminations of the erroneous views cherished by the philosophers, which are given over to the realistic views of being and non-being, will contradict the good dharma and will end in the destruction of themselves and others. It is like a wheel of fire made by a revolving firebrand, which is no wheel, but which is imagined to be one by ignorant. Is it not a wheel because it has not been seen by some? But the same reasoning, those who are in the habit of listening to the discriminations and views of the philosophers will regard things born as non-existent and those destroyed by causation as existent. It is like a mirror reflecting colors and images as determined by conditions but without any partiality. It is like the echo of the wind which gives the sound of a human voice. It is like a mirage of moving water seen in a desert. In the same way, the discriminating mind of the ignorant, which has been heated by false imaginations and speculations, is stirred into mirage-like waves by the winds of birth, growth, and destruction. Then said Mahamati to the Blessed One, "Why is it that the ignorant are given up to discrimination and the wise are not?" The Blessed One replied, "It is because the ignorant cling to names, signs, and ideas. As their mind move along these channels, they feed on multiplicities of objects and fall into the notion of an ego soul and what belongs to it. They make discriminations of good and bad among appearances and cling to the agreeable. As they thus cling, there is a reversion of ignorance and karma born of greed, anger and folly is accumulated. As the accumulation of karma goes on, they become imprisoned in a cocoon of discrimination and are henceforth unable to free themselves from the round of birth and death. Because of the folly, they do not understand that all things are like Maya, like the reflection of the moon in water, that there is no self-substance to be imagined as an ego soul and its belongings, and that all their definitive ideas rise from their false discriminations of what exists only as it is seen in the scene of the mind itself. They do not realize that things have nothing to do with qualified and qualifying, nor with the course of birth, abiding and destruction, and instead they assert that they are born of a creator, of time, of atoms, of some celestial spirit. It is because the ignorant are given up to discrimination that they move along with the stream of appearances, but it is not so with the wise. Chapter 2. Then Mahamati, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, spoke to the Blessed One, saying, "You speak of the erroneous views of the philosophers. Will you please tell us of them, and that we be on our guard against them?" The Blessed One replied, saying, "Mahamati, the error in these erroneous teachings that are generally held by the philosophers lies in this. They do not recognize that the objective world rises from the mind itself. They do not understand that the whole mind system rises from the mind itself. But depending upon these manifestations of the mind as being real, they go on discriminating them, like the simple-minded ones that they are, cherishing the dualism of this and that, of being and non-being, ignorant of the fact that there is but one common essence. On the contrary, my teaching is based upon the recognition that the objective world, like a vision, is a manifestation of the mind itself. It teaches the cessation of ignorance, desire, deed, and causality. It teaches the cessation of suffering that arises from the discrimination of the triple world. There are some Brahman scholars who, assuming something out of nothing, assert that there is a substance bound up with causation which abides in time, and that the elements that make up personality, that its environment, have their genesis and continuation in causation, and after thus existing, pass away. Then there are other scholars who hold a destructive and nihilistic view concerning such subjects as continuation, activity, breaking up, existence, nirvana, the path, karma, fruition and truth. Why? Because they have not attained an intuitive understanding of truth itself, and therefore they have no clear insight into the fundamentals of things. They are like a jar broken into pieces, which is no longer able to function as a jar. They are like a burnt seed, which is no longer capable of sprouting. But the elements that make up personality and its environment, which they regard as subject to change, are really incapable of uninterrupted transformations. Their views are based upon erroneous discriminations of the objective world. They are not based upon the true conception. Again, if it is true that something comes out of nothing and there is a rise of the mind system by reason of the combination of the three effect-producing causes, we could say the same of any non-existing thing. For instance, that a tortoise could grow hair or sand produce oil. This proposition is of no avail. It ends in affirming nothing. It follows that the deed, work and cause of which they speak is of no use. And so also is their reverence for being and non-being. If they argue that there is a combination of the three effect-producing causes, they must do it on the principle of cause and effect. That is, that something comes out of something and not out of nothing. As long as a world of relativity is asserted, there is an ever-recurring chain of causation which cannot be denied under any circumstance. Therefore, we cannot talk of anything coming to an end of cessation. As long as these scholars remain on their philosophical ground, their demonstration must conform to logic, and their textbooks and memory habit of erroneous intellection will ever cling to them. To make the matter worse, the simple-minded ones, poisoned by these erroneous views, will declare this incorrect way of thinking taught by the ignorant to be the same as that presented by the all-knowing one. Now the miscellaneous. All such notions as causation, succession, atoms, primary elements that make up personality, personal soul, supreme spirit, sovereign God, creator, are all figments of imagination and manifestations of the mind. Nevertheless, transcendental intelligence is not noble wisdom. It is only an intuitive awareness of it. Noble wisdom is a perfect state of imagelessness. It is all conserving divine mind, which in its pure essence forever abides in perfect patience and undisturbed tranquility. Transcendental intelligence rises when the intellectual mind reaches its limit, and if things are to be realized in their true and essential nature, its processes of mentation, which are based on particularized ideas, discriminations, and judgmentism, must be transcended by an appeal of some higher faculty of cognition, if there be such a higher faculty. There is such a faculty in the intuitive mind, manas, which, as we have seen in the link between the intellectual mind and the universal mind. While intuition does not give information that can be analyzed and discriminated, it gives that which is far superior, self-realization through identification. There are four things by the fulfilling which an earnest disciple may gain self-realization and noble wisdom. First, he must have a clear understanding that all things are only manifestations of the mind itself. Second, he must clearly understand the egolessness of both things and persons. As to the first, he must recognize and be fully convinced that this triple world is nothing but a complex manifestation of one's mental activities, that it is devoid of selfness and its belongings, that there are no striving, no coming, and no goings. He must recognize and accept the fact that this triple world is manifested and imagined as real only under the influences of habit energy that has been accumulated since the beginningless past. By reason of memory, false imagination, false reasoning, and attachment to the multiplicities of objects and reactions in close relationship and in conformity to ideas of body, property, and abode. As to the second thing, he must recognize and be convinced that all things are to be regarded as forms seen in a vision and a dream, empty of substance, unborn without self-nature, that all things exist only by reason of a complicated network of causation. As for the third, he must recognize and patiently accept the fact that his own mind and personality is also mind-constructed, that it is empty of substance, unborn and egoless. Fourth, rightly understanding the noble wisdom.
Well,
you must elaborate it. Okay.
Yes. Well, as I said, the last
part is not
the compilers or the selectors of these excerpts. Seem to have automatically, or for some technical reason, omitted the fourth step. The fourth step, as I was saying, was to recognize the real nature of noble wisdom, which is that it is beyond duality, that it is beyond the intellectual cognition, that it is beyond the subject and object of knowledge, and that it is free from all images, and that nothing can be predicated of it. No qualification can be made of it. So in general, the point here is that the fourth step is the correct understanding of noble wisdom, which is that noble wisdom is free from all conceptualization, that noble wisdom is free from all images, free from all predicates, all adjectives, all qualifications. So it is a transcendental realization which you cannot describe in words. And this is a theme that, of course, we've come across many times. Now, obviously, a text like this, a sutra text like this, it's difficult to follow everything. As she was reading the text, it occurs to me there may be many technical terms that have occurred in the text that may be confusing. The philosophers, for example, who are the philosophers? The philosophers are Tirthikas, the philosophers are heretics, the philosophers are non-Buddhists. Similarly, there are many, many references in the text which I suppose will be obscure to me, obscure to you. There are some that are that are obscure to me also. But the main message of the text, I think, comes through pretty clearly. Abandon all discrimination between being and non-being, existence and non-existence, one and many. Let go of clinging to this and that. Try to develop an attitude of mind which is one of interpoise, a kind of a middle way, an attitude of mind which does not judge, which does not grasp objects. Actually, this is an idea which can be put very simply. Achan Cha, the great meditation teacher in the Thai forest tradition, he used to say, whenever you get an idea, whenever you're about to make a judgment, whenever you're about to decide one way or another, just quickly reflect, not sure, not sure. You know, whatever you think, whenever you're about to make a judgment, grasp at something, think that, this is the answer, this is true, this person is good, that person is bad, this practice is right, that practice is wrong. Always immediately slap a label on it, not sure, not sure. So in that way you keep your mind free, you know, you keep your mind free of things. All the monasteries in Thailand have lots of dogs around. Achan Cha said, you don't grasp things. If you go around, you grasp a dog by the leg, he'll turn around and bite you. In the same way, if you grasp things, they'll turn around and bite you. Don't grasp things. Just let go. Not sure. Keep them at a distance. Don't grasp. Don't cling to things. Don't cling to ideas. So this is basically what this discourse is also advocating. Not to cling to ideas, not to cling to extremes, to positions, to entities, to objects. So I think, you know, we're probably at the end of our time.
Excuse me, is this teaching found in the Theravada text?
Well, definitely. No, the Buddha says actually in more than one sutra that there is nothing. It's all about grasping the water snake. You see, it depends how you take things. There's another passage in which, I think it may even be in the same sutra, in the Alagotabama Sutta, but where the Buddha talks about the, is there any danger in the object of the senses? And the Buddha says that a practitioner, a wise monk, one who practices correctly, he doesn't have anything to fear from sense objects. He doesn't have anything to fear from objects of the senses. It's like a deer, one deer who is unwise and unskillful, he will get caught in the hunter's snare. But another deer who recognizes the hunter's snare, he can lie down on the snare and not be caught, and then he can get up and walk away when the hunter approaches. So in the same way, if you are aware of if you stay clear of grasping at objects, then you won't be caught up in objects. So certainly there are, you know, similarities. I mean, Ajahn Chah is teaching from the Theravada tradition. Ajahn Chah didn't study the Mahayana. So certainly this current, this advice not to hold on to things, not to grasp things, this is a very important element in Theravada teaching as well. Anything else? Anybody have any other questions?
And secondly, that we talk about the understanding egolessness. I think these points are quite easy to understand. And in the last sentence, we have the statement that even the mind is also mind construct. It is empty of substance, unborn, and egolessness.
Yeah. You're talking about the mentalist schools or whatever, right? The Yogacara and these schools. That's the whole point. This is why the Buddhist mentalist schools are not idealism. That's why the Buddhist mentalist schools are not like the idealistic philosophy of Berkeley or some idealistic philosophies, Bradley of in the Western tradition. Because the mind itself is also empty. The mind itself is insubstantial. There's a great scholar and master of Mahayana philosophy called Shantarakshita. We'll be looking at his system and at his teaching next time we meet in January. And he writes in one of his texts that the true followers of the Mahayana rely on the two systems, the mind-only system and the emptiness system, the emptiness philosophy. And relying on the mind-only system, we understand that everything is created by mind. But relying on the emptiness system, we know that mind also is insubstantial and ultimately non-existent. You see, if we really believed, if the mentalist tradition in Buddhism affirm the reality of the mind, then we would really be guilty of being vastuvadins, no? Believers in the real existence of an entity. Because even though we call everything else unreal, we would be calling the mind real. We would be saying the mind is a substance, the mind is an entity. But we don't say that. We say that at the end of the day, look for the mind. You won't be able to find it. It's true, the mind generates everything else, but the mind itself is also empty. Ultimately, the mind itself is also empty. So there is no grasping at the mind. There is one sub-school of the Yogacara called the Nirakaravadins, which claims that mind exists independent of objects. All the other Nirakaravadins, and you look at the text of Asanga, you look at this sutra as well, which says many times, mind is neither existent nor non-existent, etc., etc. So if mind is neither existent nor non-existent, then what is it? Again, it's something that you can't pin down. And Asanga, Vasubandhu, they're all very clear that the mind is also ultimately insubstantial. And that's a very important point, because that keeps our position consistent. We're not saying everything is imaginary, everything is unreal, but the mind is real. We're saying everything is imaginary, everything is unreal, including the mind. The mind also is unreal. Ultimately, when you look for the mind, you can't find it. Is it long? Is it short? Is it inside? Is it outside? Is it in between? Where is it? Let's all of us look for the mind this evening. Let's see if we can find our mind. So, no, it is. I mean, this is it looks like a difficult point, but it's a very important point because it preserves our integrity as Buddhists, as Mahayanists, whatever, because we're not inconsistent. We don't make exceptions. Mind is also an illusion. That is, in general, my opinion. I mean, we will talk about this in more detail in January when we talk about the scholastic developments within the Mahayana tradition, within Mahayana philosophy. We'll talk about it in a lot more detail. But briefly, at this point, I would say that, in general, the two schools are complementary, and they do agree. Nagarjuna also affirms that the world is created by mental functions, by the mind and by mental derivatives or mental functions, but that the mind is ultimately empty. And the Yogacara philosophers, Asanga and Vasubandhu, they also, although they emphasize the creative role of the mind, they also, at the end of the day, they also agree that the mind is empty and insubstantial. So I would say that, in general, the sort of dichotomy, the antagonism that many scholars have described between the Madhyamaka school and Yogacara school stems from a misunderstanding. It stems from an imperfect or incomplete knowledge of the Madhyamaka teaching and an imperfect and incomplete knowledge of the Yogacara teaching. I think if you study, and I have spent a lot of time looking at this issue, and I've studied the texts of Asanga and Vasubandhu very carefully, and I'll show you in January where the statements are in the texts of the Yogacara philosophers like Asanga and Vasubandhu, which explicitly say that mind is also not existent, not independent, not real. As I say, there's one subsect of the Yogacara called the Nirakaravadins. Their representatives are Dignaga and Dharmakirti, and they affirm the reality of mind without an object. But all the other Yogacarans deny that mind is ultimately and independently existent. So there is a small sub-school. There is a sub-school of the Yogacara which does affirm the ultimate existence of mind. But the mainstream Yogacara never affirms that.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Okay, well, I suppose we can conclude. Tomorrow we will look at some of the review questions, and I will giving you our email and all of that. Okay, so thank you all, and see you tomorrow morning.